For decades now, all Milwaukee City employees have had to live within city boundaries, with a handful of exceptions. But then back in 2013, the state legislature passed a law that removed those requirements, but it did allow for cities to require certain employees, including police and fire, to live within 15 miles of city limits. And now Milwaukee's Finance Committee will consider extending residency incentives. Should public workers have to live where they work? We're at 800-642-1234. Corrine Hess is WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. So let's look at these incentives for some city employees. Help us understand what is going on, you know, with this whole incentive program for municipal employees.
Well, following the ban in 2013, the city began providing employees that were not represented by a union incentives to live in the city. So if they live in the city, they're not represented by a union, they get a 1.5% salary bump. And now the city's talking about wanting to try to expand that to police and fire.
So 1.5% pay bump if they are not represented by a union?
Correct, yes. And if they stay in the city.
What does unions have to do with this incentive program?
Well, when the legislature changed this and the Supreme Court upheld it, the whole thing had to do also with Act 10. And police and fire were exempt, so they didn't have to they negotiate. They don't have to be part of this. They negotiate their salary. And they negotiate where they live, everything. So even if the city council passes this, they're going to have to decide whether or not they accept it.
So what is the impact of this policy in Milwaukee? How has it been?
Well, it hasn't been great for the city. Out of about 6,500 employees, about 1,600 have left. And that's 25%.
And so that's quite a few people leaving. Can they tie it to this particular stipulation, this policy of living within city boundaries?
They can. This has happened just since the policy went into place.
And so the city is currently considering expanding this residency incentive policy. You know, what does that look like, this expansion or extension?
Well, like you said, right now you get a 1.5% salary bump if you're a non-union employee. If they go ahead and they negotiate with police and fire, and that's really a big if, I'm not sure if the police and fire unions will even accept that, you know, it could really mean more money for the city employees that are not represented, because, of course, if police and fire are getting more money, they could get more money, too.
Has this led to some pay gaps in the past?
It has led to pay gaps, because right now people that are getting the incentives are getting a little bit more money. Police and fire aren't getting more money. It's kind of a big mess right now. Today, the finance committee is going to meet. They're also going to talk about just hiring a consultant to look at different ways to keep people living in the city.
Corey Hess is WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee. We're talking about municipal residency requirements and the debate over whether public employees should have to live in the jurisdictions where they work. The city of Milwaukee is looking to extend its residency incentives to police and fire. And so if the incentives are expanded to include police and firefighters, would it affect people who already live in the city?
Well, that's another thing they are looking at. So right now they are, they're already getting the pay bump, but they are looking at kind of overhauling that whole program too.
What would a consultant do? What would they look at?
Several other states and municipalities have also eliminated by legislative action, municipal, boundary requirements, and they've offered incentives to employees. So I think this consultant would look at what those states have done.
And we've seen these residency requirements really go away across the country. I mean, Minneapolis, I saw in 1999 when their police and fire residency requirements went away. Why these jurisdiction requirements are going away in cities around the country?
You know, I think one argument against them is to try to attract more talent to work in the city. When former Governor Scott Walker was making the argument for it, he was saying that it would attract more teachers to Milwaukee public schools. So, or just more talent in any department if people don't have to live in the city. That's one thing that people have said.
So Milwaukee used to have this law that required municipal employees to live within city boundaries. That law, as you said, was struck down by lawmakers in 2013. Why was the city's response to create a residency incentives program? Could that be considered a loophole?
I don't think it is a loophole, mainly for the fact that, you know, this is being done across the country. And Milwaukee is really worried about this. If 25% of people have already left, this is really an economic hardship on the city. People that work here would buy homes here, they shop here, they do things in the city. So I think they want to keep their employees in the city.
Yeah, why is it so important for city workers, for safety personnel to live where they work?
In talking to an alderman this week, he was saying that when he speaks to his constituents, they say that they just feel safer having their safety personnel living here. And also, they feel more connected to the community. Whether that's true or not, I'm not sure, but that's been the argument.
So what will you be watching for today as the Finance Committee takes this up?
Well, it will be interesting if they decide to go ahead and move forward with trying to do the collective bargaining with police and fire. Both unions did not want to respond to comments. And even the alderman that I spoke to doesn't think that they would go forward with wanting to collectively bargain for this. I'm not sure if they will want to take on this fight. The union negotiations begin in the summer.
So union negotiations begin in the summer, and right now this issue is at the Finance Committee. Where would the Finance Committee take it from here?
To the full City Council.
To the full City Council. What would the timeline look like for that?
Well, that would probably happen in May. And then another thing that would need to be looked at is how much money non-union employees would make for staying in the city, and that would be a full separate item in discussion.
And that full separate item in discussion, is there debate around that?
Well, that would probably come up later in May. And again, probably, yes, that would be a whole nother debate.
Well, Corey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Corinne Hess is WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee. We've been talking about how the city of Milwaukee is considering extending incentives for its public safety personnel to live within city boundaries. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Dane County's continuous cover program. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The program gives cash incentives to farmers who convert land used for row crops into areas planted with perennial grasses. And the idea is to reduce runoff in heavy rainfalls. Fifth-generation farmer James Amara talked with WMTV about this funding stream that is helping his farm stay in business.
Every year you just got to go to the bank and get more money and hope it turns around and you can bail yourself out, I guess.
Are you a Wisconsin farmer who's dealt with flooding? Have you planted certain crops to reduce runoff from flooding rains? And could this program help your farm, whether you live in Dane County or in another part of the state? We're at 800-642-1234. Joe Parisi is Dane County Executive. Joe, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you announced this continuous cover program last week. How does this program work?
So this is one of our many partnerships that we have with our local farm families. You know, folks think of Dane County, a lot of times they think of the city of Madison and the kind of urban core of our county, but we're also one of the top 25 dairy-producing counties in the nation. And we have kind of a unique challenge in that, as you know, we have four lakes that run smack through the middle of the county. And because we are such an ag-intensive county also, one of the challenges we have to deal with is runoff when we have heavy rains from our ag lands. And so we've partnered with our farmers on a number of initiatives to help them implement practices that reduce runoff. And this is one of our latest, and we're particularly looking at working with our smaller farmers because, as you know, the farm economy is very challenged right now. You know, in the last decade, we've lost almost 140 farms in Dane County. So what this program does is it works with farmers like the one we just heard from who want to implement some unique practices. One of those practices can be converting lands that are used planted in row crops now that are more susceptible to runoff to grasses to graze their cattle. So what we have is a program we're piloting this year with about $750,000, and farmers can, and that's to incentivize farmers to try one of three different practices. The one that we just heard about is to convert to lands for grazing cattle. The other two options would be to take lands that are in production and plant them either in prairie seeds to grow prairie, which helps reduce runoff, helps hold water to reduce flooding, or to plant perennial grasses as buffer strips between, say, a stream and a crop to help catch that runoff before it gets into the water. And this is pretty much based on the federal crop set-aside program. We felt that here locally in Dane County, there was a lot of appetite for this. We could get a big bang for the buck, both in helping our smaller family farmers and in reducing runoff.
Yeah, so how do cover crops work? How do they reduce flooding or reduce the impact of runoff?
Yeah, so right now the challenge is during different times of the year when you have bare soil and it rains on that, and particularly as we've been seeing in the past few years, as our weather patterns have begun to change, we are receiving more frequent rains and heavier rains. And when that hits the soil and that runs off, that washes nutrients into the watershed that get into our lakes and can feed algae growth. So what happens for example, if someone converts to grazing, you're taking that land that for a good part of the year has a lot of bare soil and you're turning it into grass. So when the rain hits that, it's more apt to stay where it falls and to slowly soak in to the land rather than wash off. And the same with the buffer strips and the prairie. It's the same effect.
So the funding for this continuous cover program, you had mentioned $750,000. It's in the 2019 county executive's budget. How is this divided between farms?
So there's a process where farmers can apply for grants, and that goes through May 31st. So they can just reach out to the county. They can apply online. And again, since this is a pilot, we're going to see how it goes this year. We expect there to likely be more demand this first year than there is funding. But we wanted to start out relatively smaller so we can assess the program and how the implementation goes and how much appetite there is out there in the farm community for doing this. And then we'll take a look at those results and we'll gauge what we do next year partially on that.
Yeah, so this funding then, this would be like one-off cash incentive funding for the landowner. Is that a way you could look at it?
Yeah, and what it does is there's an agreement to keep the land set aside in whichever one of these crops they plant for 15 years. And so what's attractive to a lot of farmers about that, and frankly when you look at kind of our land use in Dane County. We're an incredibly fast-growing county. We're the fastest-growing county population-wise in the state. And it helps us preserve that rural character of the land while at the same time keeping farming an option. If in 15 years they want to do something different with that land, they can revisit that. So instead of having to sell it to be developed into a subdivision, which obviously takes it out of production forever, this leaves options open to the farmer, helps us grow in a smart way.
We're talking with Joe Parisi. He is Dane County Executive, recently unveiled the continuous cover program for landowners to get incentives to plant crops that help reduce runoff, grasses that reduce runoff after heavy rainfall events. Joe, for other counties that may not have this type of program and want to start a program, how did Dane County work these funds into this year's budget?
Well, this is bonding that we will go ahead and bond for, and it's part of our, again, part of our really our lakes cleanup efforts in this county. We're investing a lot of money into these efforts to address the root causes of some of the nutrient runoff into our waters. But what we're seeing also too is that this is also a benefit when it comes to our flooding initiatives when we have to deal with. I would suggest that folks talk to their farmers, gauge their interest. We have a great relationship with our farmers throughout the county. The farmers know what needs to be done. They've been great partners for us, and I think if other units of local government, other counties, continue to have conversations with their farmers about what they'd like to implement but perhaps don't have the resources to do so, particularly the smaller farms, they can come up with some great ideas.
And as you've talked to county farmers, have you come across any resistance or hesitation about doing this with their land?
Yeah, I mean, this is completely voluntary, so there are going to be folks who aren't interested in it, but what we found is that a lot of folks are interested in it. You know, our farmers care deeply about the land. They want to keep the soil on the land. They care about our natural environment. They don't always have the means, the smaller farmers, to implement some of these practices on their own, however. But what was interesting, you know, with James Amera, the farmer who's we heard from earlier, who's turning to rotational grazing, you know, he said that his grandfather said, well, you know, this is new, but this is the way we used to do things.
Hmm.
So it's really interesting. It's kind of coming full circle for some folks. And, you know, and rotational grazing won't be the thing for every farmer. Buffer, you know, prairie patches won't be the thing for every farmer. But, you know, if you work with them, there's a lot of interest out there. So we look at it as the art of the possible, right? There'd be some folks who may not want to go down that route, but there'd be a lot that do, and we want to work with them to move forward. It's kind of the low-hanging fruit, really. They're folks who want to implement these practices, and we want to help them do that.
You said earlier Dane County farmers have until May 31st to apply, yeah. And this is part of a 15-year agreement. What is that application process like?
Well, they just fill out a form, and they have to, you know, talk about the type of land that they're looking at converting and improving. Is it in row crop now, or is it, you know, degraded land that they want to improve? And this fill out a form. It's not, you know, too complicated, and you know they can talk with our folks, you know, to talk them through it, to talk about what we're looking for, to see if what they're thinking of might be something that would be looked favorably upon through the application process. And you know they could also kind of look and see how it goes this year and see what that process looks like and get ready to apply for the next year too.
Are there specific eligibility requirements? I'm thinking how much land that they have to own?
Yeah, so it's really not too onerous. You know, it's the minimum acreage is a half acre and a maximum up to 40 acres. So, you know, it's, again, it hopefully will look attractive to some of the smaller farmers. And really, even smaller amounts of acreage planted in grasses can have a big impact. You know, for example, say that your crops, you know, abut a stream. You know, a strip of grass a few feet wide along a stream can make a big difference. It can make a big difference as far as runoff, and it can also then provide even, you know, more wildlife habitat too. So that's the nice thing. We can target this program to the most vulnerable lands where you get a big return on your investment while at the same time helping farmers maintain their family farm.
And earlier we heard from James Amara, who is a fifth-generation farmer in Stoughton. He talked with WMTV about the program.
I probably wouldn't have done half of what I'm doing this year is if they didn't have that program.
So after hearing that, what are you hoping to further achieve through this program?
Well, like I said, you know, the farmers want to, they want to keep their family farms going, which is getting much more difficult. So if we can partner with them, infuse a little more capital into their operation to help them get going in a new direction in the case of James. But again, not everyone's going to want to go in that direction.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Joe. We have to go. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Joe Parisi, Dane County Executive. We've been talking about a new program that incentivizes farmers to plant crops that reduce runoff. Coming up, we look at the human toll of cold cases and what Milwaukee is trying to do to crack down on unsolved homicides. That's after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about what it means to get justice after a homicide and what leads up to deadly violence in Milwaukee. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and it's difficult to get a full picture of how justice is served for a victim's family because the goals and objectives of the police department and the DA's office and the courts, they're all different. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has spent months analyzing data from agencies tracking homicides from the time they occurred through the court process. What questions do you have about unsolved homicides in Milwaukee? What do you want to know about police strategies or how the courts handle these cases? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ashley Lutheran covers public safety and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been investigating unsolved homicides for an O'Brien Fellowship in Public Service Journalism at Marquette University. Ashley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me this morning.
You've been investigating how often killers end up getting charged, convicted, and sentenced in Milwaukee. Why did you want to pick apart this data? Because don't numbers tell the story?
I really appreciate you asking that question. For me, I've been covering public safety in the city of Milwaukee for 6 years now. And throughout that time, it became very clear that what's most important to family members of homicide victims is seeing someone held accountable in court for their loved one's death. And the statistics that are routinely provided by police departments, the prosecutor's office, and the court system, all of those data points are sort of given out in isolation from one another. So it can be really hard to get an accurate picture of what, it seems like a simple question. How many homicides in the city of Milwaukee end up with a suspect convicted and sentenced for a crime related to the killing? And it's actually really hard to find.
Because there's this nuance, or is it because there are just different strategies that the police department is looking at versus what the court system is trying to achieve?
I think it's both. There are certainly different standards within each system. So when a police department is arresting someone for a crime and referring them to the district attorney's office for charges, that requires a lesser standard of proof. When a district attorney is issuing a charge, they are often saying we are charging cases in which we feel confident we can prove them in court. So we have a higher standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And then even when it comes to the court system, right, in a trial, in a court proceeding, you can only examine the evidence that's presented in court, the evidence that is put in front of a jury, a judge, and for very good reason, sometimes evidence doesn't make it in, or to protect a defendant's constitutional rights, other information is excluded. And so each operates under its own set of rules. Yes.
So while covering crime as a reporter over these last 6 years, what have you heard from victims' families who have had questions, lingering questions, who are seeking justice?
They are just incredibly frustrated. Like many big systems and bureaucracies, it's not really friendly, and it's not often explained very well to members of the community in general. And reporters, we are going through our daily stories, and we're trying to put as much context as we can, and we're using these data points, but sometimes we don't often fully explain what they mean. And for victims' families, they just have this lingering question of who did this and why, and it just continues to loom over their life. I wrote a piece within this series that's, and the series is ongoing throughout the year, but I wrote a secondary piece about the specific kind of grief that comes after a homicide. And really, it's just so different because it's so profoundly unfair. It's sudden. It's violent. It brings all of this stigma. And then if you add on top of that, you don't even really know why it happened, and you don't see someone held accountable for taking your loved one's life. It's just incredibly sad.
So you spent 6 months gathering, analyzing all this data from these agencies tracking homicides from the time they occur through the court process. Why isn't this information all in one place?
You know, I think like a lot of things within government agencies, a lot of these systems were set up decades ago, and they were set up before it was very easy to share information. And sometimes they just haven't been updated. Other times it's as simple as, like, for example, in the police department, a lot of this information is tracked by the victim because that's sort of the first piece of information that the police department is getting. So we know who the victim is in this crime. Once it enters into the prosecutor's office and the court system, it's all really under the suspect's information, the defendant's information. And so sometimes these systems don't talk very well together, just even with improved technology. So one big thing I did, and I had student interns who were assisting me, as well as colleagues in the newsroom double-checking my work, we had to link those victims and suspects across those systems. So we were pretty much looking at when an offense occurred and then going into individual court filings to make sure we had the proper case. Because you might be surprised how it can be very confusing sometimes if you're just looking at when an offense occurred and the crimes that were charged on that date that could conceivably be related to a homicide, because not every homicide case gets charged as a first-degree intentional homicide. You know, maybe prosecutors feel they don't have that much evidence to prove that charge, so they go with a different kind of charge.
Mm. Talking with Ashley Lutheran, she covers public safety breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been investigating unsolved homicides in Milwaukee through a fellowship at Marquette University. Ashley, how helpful were police and prosecutors through your parsing of all this data? I mean, in some ways, you were investigating how they're doing on the job.
Yeah, absolutely. And I must say, you know, the Milwaukee Police Department and the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office, they provided, I filed records requests, they provided data. When I had questions, we sat down and went over that. I had many conversations, both on background just to inform my reporting, and then of course on the record. And I think what I really appreciated was, particularly with the Milwaukee Police Department, when I had about, I would say, a little over two dozen cases over the 5 years we examined, where I just could not, I had questions. The case was coded one way within the police department data, but I couldn't find a charged suspect. And I couldn't figure out what was happening. They did make a captain from the homicide unit available to go point by point with me. Because as I explained to them, my goal is just to be accurate and to explain what's going on. It's not a gotcha story. It's just to kind of peel apart these numbers and explain to the public what they mean.
Could they sleuth through all of the questions that you had? Could they arrive at answers for you?
Yes. Particularly the Milwaukee Police Department, they know these homicide cases inside and out. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that, you know, victims' families might not always, you know, get the opportunity to sit down and do that. So I wanted to be a voice for them as well in these meetings and ask these questions that they had too.
Let's talk about this clearance rate. Police agencies represent how often they solve crimes with something called a clearance rate. And
yeah,
you've called that number at best misunderstood, at worst misleading. Can you explain how police tally up their clearance rates?
Sure. And let's take a step back. Like I said, many of these measures were developed decades ago. They function. So a clearance rate is a very, you know, it is the valid standard way of calculating when crimes are solved in a given year. But the problem that I've or the problem as I see it, again, like you said, is that the public doesn't really understand what it means. If you ask a department how many homicides they've solved in a year, they pretty much always give you the clearance rate. So because of when that process developed, the clearance rate, first of all, includes all arrests for homicide cases made within a calendar year, and that's for any homicides that occurred in the past as well. So, for example, if you look at 2018, you know, the Milwaukee Police Department posted a 76% clearance rate, which is really, above the national average. It's pretty good if you talk to national experts. What does that number really mean? It doesn't mean that 76% of 2018 homicides were solved. What it means is that by the end, they took all the homicide arrests and cases that they referred to the DA's office, and they for all cases, and divided it by the number of homicides that occurred in 2018. So essentially, if you look just at the 2018 homicides, by the end of the year, only 51% of them had a suspect arrested and charged in court. Now, that's some people might say, well, that's just a calculation error. We've been that's just how the measure is done.
Right.
And so if you're comparing years over data, like that's a fair comparison, which I would say, sure. And again, as long as people understand what that means, that's okay. And even if you look only at clearance rates, you know, the department's self-reported report card, if you will, on how they're doing, something was clearly happening from 2008 to 2015 in particular. The department's clearance rate reached a high of 93% in 2008, and it continued to just drop every single year and bottomed out in 2015 at 58%. And it's been rising again, but some experts argue part of that is because the pace of homicides has slowed down in Milwaukee, and that the department's the detectives are able to kind of clear some of these older cases.
Yeah.
The other issue is,
Well, you found Milwaukee police cleared 7 homicides that occurred from 1932 to 1962, but they didn't do that until 1999. So I think that's another example of what you're talking about, going into the past as part of this data.
Right. And it's very hard to sort of pick that apart. Mm. And I think the other issue is that A clearance doesn't mean that someone was held accountable in court for this homicide. It typically means, and sometimes it's not possible, right? So sometimes in cases, for example, of a murder-suicide, obviously that offender can't be held accountable because they're now deceased. So that goes on there. But in other cases, like the older example that you mentioned, which the Journal Sentinel had reported on at the time back in 2000, that was a case in which the department back then, under very different leadership, they had made the decision that, well, the offenders in these homicides must be deceased at this point because they are so dated. And so there is a quality here where you can do different kinds of exceptional clearances. Now, again, when I sat down with the police department to review individual cases, they were very clear that no longer, they took repeated steps to show me exactly how they determine whether or not a case is cleared and all the different standards of review that now go into that.
We have to pause right there with reporter Ashley Luther, and you can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. Families of homicide victims in Milwaukee ask if there's anything they can do to bring attention to their cold case and help solve the murder of their loved one. A Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigation crunched the numbers on unsolved homicides and what justice looks like for families today. We're talking about the results here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And the question seemed so simple, right? How many homicides result in a killer charged and convicted of a crime? It's not exactly a straightforward answer. What questions do you have about unsolved murders in Milwaukee? What do you think police should be doing to solve more homicide cases? Should patrol officers be spending more time in neighborhoods, or should there be more detectives? What ideas do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ashley Lutheran covers public safety and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been investigating unsolved homicides in Milwaukee. Ashley, before we went to the break there, one more thing before we move on from clearance rates. If clearance rates aren't exactly something you can take at face value, these numbers, these percentages, is there a better way to show a case resolved, case closed?
You know, if there is, it hasn't quite been developed yet. These are measures that are reported to the federal government, to the FBI, as part of its uniform crime reporting program. That is going to be changing, going to more of an incident-based system. And I think then there might be, you know, as the technology improves, there might be a better way to track those and to track outcomes.
So you studied 594 homicides that happened from 2014 to last year. How often did you find that cases remain unsolved, that is, without anyone being charged?
So in about 38% of cases, they were completely sort of unsolved, but, you know, no one, I flipped some of these. Essentially, in 58% of that five-year period, someone was charged with a crime. And most of the time, those charges came within 2 weeks of the homicide. And then when we looked at the conviction information, we narrowed it down to 2014 to 2017 because of the time it takes for the average case to move through the court system, because we had tracked that information as well. So we were able to say it takes just under a year usually for a case to go from being charged to resolving. And so in that case, we found over that four-year period, 47% ended with someone convicted of a crime. And we made it that broad because it can be very difficult to, you know, if you were looking just at the number of people convicted of an actual homicide offense, it would be slightly smaller because there, as I mentioned before, there are other offenses. People, you know, plead to a lesser charge and that sort of thing happens within the court system too.
Well, let's take a call now. Let's go to Cindy joining us from Appleton. Good morning, Cindy.
Hello. Well, there's a few things I'd like to say. First of all, putting more officers on the street is not the ideal situation here, because all they do is create more homicides. I think the community needs to become more involved and get more active in this. And I wish they could find some major donors to put up like maybe $1 million so that when something like this happens, the police department could offer like a $10,000 reward for information that leads to the arrest and conviction. And then maybe people would feel comfortable coming forward because they'd be paid to do it, because most people don't come forward because they're afraid of the repercussions or getting police involved in their business, which they don't want to do.
Cindy, thanks for the call. And, you know, Ashley, what about tips? What about this cycle in Milwaukee about getting people to come forward?
So I think there are a couple of ways to do that. You know, in some high profile cases, as Cindy mentioned, you know, there have been monetary rewards given. I think for, you know, what I found in terms of policing strategy, something that seasoned detectives and outside experts have mentioned is it's really important to have a robust, you need to have many departments within the police agency that are talking to each other. So usually if a homicide unit isn't going to be starved of resources, but all those support units, the ones that investigate non-fatal shootings or violent crimes like robberies, if those detective ranks start dwindling or the resources to investigate those crimes aren't adequate, then you kind of have a dip in information sharing. So one thing that in Milwaukee people really pointed to was this loss of a confidential informant network because of all these other investigations that were happening. That led to information. So detectives had a very good idea of what was happening on the street, who maybe was arguing with who, what crimes may be related, and having a better understanding of crime affecting things citywide. That capacity was diminished during the tenure of the previous police chief, in large part because he focused on a patrol-based strategy. He wanted more officers out on the streets. He wanted to prevent crime. And that was a very common, very well thought of policing strategy at that particular time.
That was Edward Flynn.
Yes. And now at this it's kind of interesting because the pendulum's swinging the other way now, and you're seeing a lot more reporting and academic research and policing leaders kind of looking at the importance of solving crimes as not only a way to prevent future crimes, but as a way to build legitimacy within communities that they may not have the best relationship with.
Well, so under Police Chief Flynn, the city experienced fewer homicides for a number of years, but also fewer homicides were being solved. So why were fewer homicides being solved?
It was, you know, from the people I've talked to and the reporting I've done, it was just that reason I was talking about. There was a real decline in the kind of the human intelligence that was coming in. And there also was a shift in priorities. The priority was on preventing crime. And there are people who can make very strong and very sincere arguments that that strategy worked with those decline in homicides. But then again, near the end of Chief Flynn's tenure, you know, we saw a spike in homicides, and people still haven't necessarily, you know, focused in on why that happened. It wasn't just happening in Milwaukee. It was happening in other cities. And so I think, you know, it does become a question of, you know, one of the experts I talked to is pretty much Charles Walford, who's kind of the expert in homicide clearances, said it's always a question of priorities and volume. Mm. What is the police department can't do everything. So they're going to prioritize what's important to them. The new police chief, Alfonso Morales, here in Milwaukee, he has said that he has a priority on addressing violent crime, specifically shootings and homicides. Clearing cases matters a great deal to him. And so I think you're seeing that in terms of where he's directing resources in the department now.
Is he seeing more success with solving homicides?
You know, he points to those increasing clearance rates as a measure of success. And he, you know, in his interview, we had a video with him included in the piece, and I quoted him. You know, he has said, you know, we can always do better. We're going to try to do better. I think it will be really interesting. I'm going to have some future stories about how the department is addressing non-fatal shootings and sort of the impact that they believe that's having on homicides in the city. And so I'll be going more in depth about his current strategy in future stories.
Ashley, I want to end on trauma because the Journal Sentinel has been writing about the lasting impact of trauma in Milwaukee over the past few years. I think the thing that still, you know, I see in my mind's eye is when you wrote about the mother who is at the graveside of her son, 26-year-old, shot and killed, and she pulls out her hair as his casket is lowered into the ground and puts it on the casket. And there is such intense sadness there.
Yeah. You know, I was very fortunate to meet Shannon Allen and to meet other mothers like her who are willing to share their story. And I think it's important that while there is incredible pain and grief and trauma, it's really important to look at the resiliency of mothers like Shannon who are sharing their story, who are moving throughout the day and are, you know, trying to navigate their grief and their, you know, new life situation as best they can. And a lot of times you see mothers who go on and they channel that energy into, you know, making their own nonprofit, making a legacy for their loved one and for themselves and giving themselves a purpose. They are the most incredible people I have met on this job.
Ashley, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for your work. Ashley Lutheran covers public safety and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's been investigating unsolved homicides in Milwaukee. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.